Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop RPG mechanic, place it beneath our butts, and wait for it to hatch. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and today I have not one, but two co-hosts, Colly Lowry and Dan Phipps, collectively known as Gem Room Games. I'm going to start this intro with today's game, Merkborg, designed by Pell Nilsson, with graphic design by Johan Noor, an OSR dungeon crawler that describes itself as a doom metal album of a game, a spiked flail to the face, light on rules, heavy on everything else. You'll pay for your whole seat, but you'll only use the edge. Merkborg is famous for the absolute assault on the eyes, complimentary, committed by its graphic design. And in a season about how mechanics can be more than just rules, I really wanted to cover this. And I thought, who better to talk to about that than Gem Room Games, who've thought about the graphic design a lot as they've worked on their own game, Duckburg, a loving satire and mashup of Merkborg and DuckTales, and which is on Kickstarter right now. Don't walk, run to your phone and check out the link in the show notes. We didn't stop there, because Gem Room Games wanted to bring in another mechanic from Merkborg 2, and I figured, two co-hosts? Two mechanics, why not? Two of everything! Two Kickstarters to plug! Remember that this very show is going to be kickstarting its third season in October, and you can go into the show notes right now and get a link to sign up for that when it launches. So, we're also talking about the Calendar of Necrubal, a part rollable table, part in-game apocalyptic prophecy that sets the tone for the world of Merkborg in a completely different way than its look does. A final note before we begin, it didn't occur to me until after recording that I'd have loved to talk with Dan and Colly about whether we think Merkborg is an accessible game for low vision people. Like, sure, there's a bare bones edition that is plain text, but as you're about to hear us discuss, it's undeniable that you lose a lot of what Merkborg is when you can't see it. So I've got lined up a companion episode to this one, all about art and accessibility with Merkborg's graphic design as a jumping off point. We haven't even recorded it yet, so it might be a bit, but just know that that's coming and get excited. In the meantime, I'd love to see an attempt at like a Merkborg audiobook, Merkborg alt text jam when. So, two Kickstarters, Duckburg, Dice Exploder. Two co-hosts, Colly Lowry and Dan Phipps, and two mechanics, Merkborg's graphic design and the Calendar of Necrubal.
Let's talk about my favorite comedy game.
Colly, Dan, Gem Room Games, welcome to Dice Exploder. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Really excited to be here.
Yeah, so what have I forced you to come talk about on this show?
So today we are talking about Merkborg, and we were dragged here to the charnel pits to talk about its graphic design.
Yeah.
And how that intersects with play.
Yeah. So, all right, let's start with a little fictional context. So do one of you want to tell me about like the world and the setting of Merkborg?
Yeah. So Merkborg, I forget this when I think about Merkborg, but it does spend a lot of time on like this very specific setting with this sort of, and I'm not going to pronounce any of this correctly, but there is two-headed basilisks with four heads that have argued for hundreds of years. And so there's a lot of he and she, which I believe are the two basilisks, which have been arguing for so long that the world is dying. And like, that is the most important thing about the setting. Like the hard frame of this whole thing is there's a ticking clock of everything's going to end and kind of none of this matters. Cause well, worst thing was just wait a couple weeks and that'll solve all your problems.
There's a bit of nihilism there.
Yeah. There's a couple of cities. There's Graven Tosk and Gallenbeck. There's the Endless Sea and the Bergen Crypt. Everything is very like Nordic, death metal, grim, but like all of these things, right? Like, I mean, they matter, you know, like obviously I don't want to suggest they don't, but like you don't even actually need to read them super closely, even though you'd be well rewarded if you did. It's like pretty good world building prose, but like you can just look at the way the Western Kingdom is written and it's like, oh, I get it. There's a skull. there's a bunch of creepy guys. It's called Wasteland in some songs. There's Lake Lunda.
But you got, you know, your Dying World, your occult, your gothic cathedrals. Mm-hmm. This is where I feel like the art in the book. I have actually read people saying that the art in this book is useless. And it's like, this is the worst possible
example
of that, because the art in this does so much to tell you about the tone and the world and what's going on in it. Like, you can read the words and find out exactly what is going on here. You can also flip through and get a really strong sense of it just from the violence and the sharp lines and dramatic colors.
That's what I was going to say, is that, like, in some ways, you learn the same apocalyptic tone from a rollable table that is a picture of a guy stabbed with 10 different weapons as you do from, like, there's some sort of apocalyptic basilisk out there and the world's ending. Like, I understand what you are trying to convey, author, from both of those things.
Well, and the fact that this is what you have instead of a more straightforward table, that there is a requirement for you to engage with this type of a visual.
Yeah. All right, so let's get into the meat of this thing. I'm obsessed with the graphic design on this game. It's legendary. If you're listening to this show, like, you probably have taken a look at this thing, and if you have not, I certainly can't do it justice, but I don't know, either you want to take a crack at what this thing looks like?
So I actually spent a lot of time, like, taking notes on what it looks like and breaking it down and sketching it and so on, so I might be a little in the weeds with it.
Yeah.
But it's got a strong color scheme. It's got a sort of zany quality to the way that it is assembled. Strong art, a mix of original illustration and public domain stuff.
The spine is glow in the dark.
The spine is glow in the dark.
There are letters that show up under UV light.
Everybody talks about the fact that it's got like 80 different fonts.
Yeah.
But not that they actually achieve things. I think people get stuck on, it's got 80 fonts, and not, it's got 80 fonts that function to help convey the tone of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what is being attempted here is broadly misunderstood. And, you know, it makes sense, because RPG fans have an affinity for rules frequently. And this is a pretty massive flex in the knowing the rules well enough to break them school. But also, like, the level of thought, like, I think when they went to print, and I'm trying to look this up to confirm it, but I'm pretty sure Johan talked at some point about how most of the time you get, like, CMYK.
Yeah.
And they actually did custom print to get CMYK and then Merkboard Yellow and Merkboard Pink as, like, their own dedicated ink.
Wow.
Into the thing to make it so vibrant. And then they did, like, even more for Cyborg, I think. So it's very, like, thought about at every possible level to become this wild physical object.
Yeah, I think people discount just how thoughtfully made this was.
Yeah. I immediately have, like, six other things I want to say. So the first is, like, my understanding is that Johan has, like, a rich history in graphic design and this kind of visual style as a career. Is that right?
You know, my understanding is that he definitely has some professional knowledge and experience in that, but definitely this is one of those, if you are, say, a teeny tiny indie designer trying to do it yourself, you should not look at this and feel bad that this isn't what you could accomplish on your second try.
Yes. That was the thing I really wanted to underline, because I certainly remember opening this book for the first time and being like, well, I'm not going to do this career. I'm out. Like, I can't do it. Like, it's fine. And it's just so delightful to look at, assuming you delight in over-the-top misery to comedic effect.
One of my favorite ways to look at it is side by side with Into the Odd Remastered, because Johan did both, and it's such a delightful example of the breadth of skill there.
Yeah.
And I think really underlines, again, I've spent a lot of time kind of analyzing the layout here, but there's so much in this that, like, it's got a really solid structure. It's really good bones. upon which all of the sort of chaotic violence is built. And I love that, how like you can look at it and just go, oh my God, this is overwhelming and violent. And sometimes people get this misconception that that's all there is to it, is chaos and visual violence, and that you can't possibly read it or understand it because it's so visually chaotic. It's like, no, there's really solid bones there supporting all of that visual violence so that you can still read it and enjoy it in that way. Like, there's such good skill in this.
I mean, and I'm sympathetic to people who maybe don't love this because it is adversarial. Like, it is fighting
with you. It's a tongue piece.
But it's, you know, it is fighting fair at the very least and playfully.
Well, and I get, you know, using the bare bones version when you want to actually sit down and play and use it as a reference piece instead of engaging with it as a tone piece unto itself. But
rules are all on the back. It's fine.
All right. So this is a podcast about examples. So I would love, Kali, if you would just pick like your favorite spread in this book and do your best to like walk through it and explain what it looks like and how that is leading to function.
Oh, oh boy, the face that I just made. here, Dan, say something while I flip through and try to. Oh, that's a good one.
That was my favorite. Well, we can get back. Actually, no, that's my favorite. I think that one's my favorite.
So what I'm noticing as I flip through is most of our favorites are pages with tables. Pages like 44 and 45, Arcane Catastrophes. First of all, the whole spread is this sort of neon yellow in your face. On the left side, you've got this huge, bold, hot pink text that's kind of wobbly and skinny and tall and a little bit hard to read, but not impossible to read at all. And over that is slapped this black, rough, hand-lettered looking text. On the right side, you got two fonts, but mostly it's slight changes in size. Some of the text is pink, most of it is black. The major thing that shakes the page up is that the alignment of the columns, it's sort of like you took the page and shook it a couple times, just a little gently, and things got a little skewed out. Or like I'm looking at the rightmost column, which has numbers 11 through 20. And the point is, instead of it being one column straight down, 14 goes straight to 16, and then 15 is kind of squeezed in beside those in its own little sub-column. And I don't know, it conveys a lot of action and energy and motion in the way that it is set up.
Yeah. How does this all make you feel, like, looking at this spread and the way that the page has been shaken, as you say?
I mean, it's unsettling, right? Like, you look at it, it's not welcoming you in for a quick, easy read. It shakes you, too. It makes your eyes jump back and forth and adjust to a couple of things the same way that the text itself is doing.
Well, and like, think about the moment at the table where you're rolling. Like, this is when you've ruined a spell and something very bad is about to happen, right? Like, that's the moment. Like, you know, in video games, there's like they call it juice when there's screen shake and slow-mo and all that sort of stuff. And there's something really juicy about, like, everyone at the table knows something bad is going to happen to the wizard. It might happen to all of them. And it's the agonizing amount of time you spend rolling a d20 and looking through this thing and then noticing in the upper right corner where the text like kind of goes around and then is sideways about what happens if you roll the same thing twice and like what the italics means. Like, while your dungeon master is trying to find the 15.
Yeah.
Like, arguably, that's bad interface design, but also, like, that's what a game kind of is like, yeah, it's needlessly difficult to get what you want. And that just it's stretching that agonizing moment while you wait to find out if a two-headed basilisk that got multiple pages at the beginning of being the harbinger of the end of days. This is going to snap you right up.
Well, that, that anxiety that that brings is totally appropriate to the world of the game. Yeah. It does a really good job of reinforcing itself over and over in that way.
Yeah.
Something you said in there, too, about how it's difficult to engage with in certain ways. I think it's not inviting to read, as you say. And I think that it's like the book itself is stepping up and demanding that you be an active reader, an active engager with the text in a way that I think fits the idea of playing a game especially well. Like, because of the way it's laid out, it forces you to be paying attention at all times or to go find something else. And if you want to find something else, Morkborg sure as shit doesn't care.
Yeah.
Well, and the reason this works is because it's not like, oh, hey, this is a world that's hard and difficult and weird and everything wants to kill you, laid out in a classical textbook style. It's like, and
everything is hard and weird and difficult and wants to kill you. Yeah. This is appropriate.
While still having that undercurrent, same as like, yeah, okay, the game is trying to kill you. The rules are so easy to pick up. And it's the same with the content of this book. It is a difficult world. It is difficult text. It is difficult graphic design made easy to engage with in its weird way. Like, the difference between the rules and in the graphic design is the difference between hard because it's bad and hard because they wanted to make it a satisfying, challenging experience.
Well, and I think minimal rules also is what you want in a game that is primarily concerned with its graphic design. Like, if it had really complicated rules, that wouldn't leave nearly as much space for the visual assault that is the primary thrust of this game, right?
Yeah, I think that it's the world and the tone that they've made for you to play in that is the most important. And at every turn, that's what is the most emphasized.
Yeah, it kind of lets itself be what it needs to be. Whereas this is not a consistently Baroque text or work, so it makes sense to not have consistently Baroque rules to ride alongside.
All right. I also want to double back to my favorite spread, which I mentioned earlier, that rollable table of weapons. Dan, do you want to tell us about this one?
Yeah, it's a D10 table that's given three pages. I'm sorry, four pages. I apologize. Two spreads for 10 entries.
Yeah.
Of just like, here are the cool weapons and a whole page for femur, which is when I knew this is the comedy moment of this. The reason that this book is my favorite comedy RPG is 100% the reason why I love the comedy in especially the first act of the Barbie movie, because there are very few jokes in the first act of the Barbie movie, like aside from the beach off sequence, but like there aren't very many jokes. It's mostly just someone is sitting down and saying, hey, if we really think about how Barbie Land would work, let's just spend a long time here. And it's just
genuinely commit to that.
And like, just it's a depth of thought of like, okay, well, what if this was the most bleak thing possible?
Yeah.
And let's just let that ride. Like, if the world is ending at the beginning of your RPG, what makes sense from there? And it's what makes sense is 10% of the time you're the only thing you own is a bone that you just found on the ground. Everybody's got a bone. Like, hot, mwah, peak comedy.
The thing in Barbie that I remember from that first half hour is the moment when she steps out of her shoes and her feet are still shaped like high heels. And the magic of that visual moment, it's a gag, right? But it also does all of the world building you are talking about. It, like, is it a joke, or like, do you laugh at it, or is it just something that you kind of marvel at?
Or that incredible depth of commitment?
Yeah, exactly.
Because it is real. Barbie's feet are like that, and they did a really good job also. Yeah, basically, I think Dan and I have talked a lot about humor because we've made a couple of funny games now, and our favorite, I'm speaking for Dan when I say our favorite type of humor is the humor that really commits genuinely. It's not trying to make fun of the subject. It's committing to the subject, and the humor springs from naturally as opposed to trying to pull jokes out of that by force.
Yeah, I think using the Barbie stepping out of the heels moment as an example, which is, you know, Merkborg's femur to me, is like both of those are... They're definitely jokes. I say they're not jokes, but they're jokes. It's just, it's a clear understanding of like who gets to be funny and who's the straight man. And like, I think a lesser movie and a lesser game would have thought that it is the author of the game's job to be the funny one here. And no, you're the straight man. You're just telling the facts and letting the world be wild and like trusting that that is like enough to like,
it's GMing. You come up with the problems. Solutions are somebody else's department. You just commit.
People love to show up to the table and meme, right? What you want to do is give them a fun container to meme inside.
And again, this is a very strong flavor of game, and it is definitely not going to be everyone's cup of tea. But what I love about it is it's the emptiness of the bowl of like, I'm building this fucked up bowl with spikes all over that's hard to pick up and crack and creating lots of space for you to be like, yep, I'm femur guy. It's not going to tell you what to do with the fact that you're femur guy. You get to discover that.
Yeah. I have always compared Merkborg in my head to a different movie, John Wick, where my experience watching John Wick the first time was like, you know, it takes half an hour before you get to the first human murder in that movie. And it is a little unclear for a lot of that how seriously the movie is taking itself. But at some point in there, you get the Russian guy like on the phone just going like, oh, or you get like some cool, weird title on the screen that is just a little too poppy for a movie that was taking itself super seriously. And so by the time John shows up and like murders 16 people or whatever it is, you kind of have figured out like, oh, this is a movie that is daring me to take it seriously, even though it understands how silly and just fun it is actually going to be. And I see that same sort of daring you to take it seriously quality in Merkborg.
Like, we're going to take it seriously and dare you to go along on that ride with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an incredible sincerity in both of them. Like, everyone involved in John Wick thinks John Wick is the coolest thing in the world. And I think that's, you know, and you see comedies that like, what's the difference between Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which is explicitly a comedy, like it's a jokey horror comedy, versus like the long list that we could spend all day doing of attempts at horror comedy that don't land.
Yeah.
And I think for me, if you set out to make a bad movie, you're gonna achieve that goal. But to me, you know, taste, subjective, whatever, but there's no moment in those movies where they stick the landing, where they are like looking down their nose at the horror movies that they're playing in. And it's the same thing with Merkborg, and like, because Merkborg is relatively late to the OSR, post-OSR, and the, you know, these are genre terms that are fuzzy and ill-defined
at best
by their nature. But it's a relative latecomer to the scene, and it goes really, really hard, and I think it goes really, really sincere. Like, this is made with tremendous love for a style and philosophy of play.
Yeah, we talk a lot about sincerity and how that makes comedy work. And I think love also here we are talking about Merkborg, and I'm like, it's the love that really makes this work for
me. Yeah, Merkborg is an act of love.
It is, but because you love it, so you commit to it, and that commitment is what allows humor to come out of it.
Yeah, I think that commitment that you've brought up a couple of times, I so agree that it is the thing that is making this work. But I also think that it is a outgrowth of, like, there's the idea of the movie that's so bad it's good. And I have spent a lot of time in my life trying to challenge people on whether those movies are actually bad. You know, like, if it's good, if you love it, doesn't that just make it good?
Like the Fast and the Furious movies.
Yes, perfect.
When you watch that, you know that people were having a good time making that.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I chafe at the phrase elevated horror as like a distinct kind of horror. And it's like, no, that's nothing. You just don't like that you like a horror movie. So yeah. You're giving yourself an out by calling it elevated horror. And I think also like remembering when Mirkborg came out, I think this is in conversation with a long tradition of games that played with these themes, but like were kind of difficult to engage with because they have kind of rough histories around the people involved in their creation and the subject matter and whether or not they were made by people who wanted everyone to have a good time. Mm-hmm. Whereas Mirkborg, in its license, is like, hey, you can't be transphobic if you want us to, like, bless this mess. There's just a little bit of, like, genuine appreciation and also something similar to what happened with the flare-up of like the Sword Dream movement to be like, hey, can we have our fun dark adventure game and kick the Nazis out, please? Could we have that?
I think there's a good point of clarification too. We've been talking a lot about sincerity and commitment, and that doesn't mean that you can't be playing with something and enjoying it also. Like, just because you have committed sincerely to making a thing in a world, you are still playing in it. You are still engaging with it. The makers can be having fun while they are seriously enjoying it. They should be enjoying it.
So speaking of all of the comedy elements that we've been talking about, like, I think Duckborg, your supplement for Mirkborg, is brilliant. And I would love for you to sort of set up, like, what is it exactly and how did it come about and how do you see it fitting into all of this?
So the context for Duckburg is that, you know, Mirkborg came out, big hit, and then they announced Cyborg. And then that kicked off on, I think, the Brain Trust Discord, a lot of Borg puns. He's like, oh, they're going to do Cyborg. What's next? And then one of them, I did Life is Like a Hurricane here in Duckburg, Borg, and immediately got a fuck off, Dan. And it was like, great, we have a hit.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, if this is still funny in 6 months, then I'll make it. And it was. But the goal of it was that same thing I was talking about earlier of like, okay, if we're doing this, we're going to do it. Like, how does this happen? Like, what is this world? And like, looking at the fiction in Mirkborg and like, well, what happened to that world? And like, okay, well, that was a world like ours that these basilisks happened to. And now it's like this and it's dying. So let's chart the path for, well, what if you start with Saturday morning cartoons and go along the same arc? And leaning really heavily on the visual language and the organizational language of how Mirkborg told that story. Like, what would Scrooge McDuck see at the tabletop RPG store he would not buy because the margins are too thin? And like, Duckburg is what we imagine would be on the shelf.
Yeah. The thing I love about Duckburg is that it takes that thought we were talking about earlier of Mirkborg daring the reader to take it seriously and is like, okay, but would you take Duckburg seriously? like just, it kicks it up a notch to just like make everything clearer and like to like double down at people about everything. It's just,
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. We are dead serious about this game. It is our most serious piece of art that we have ever made.
I mean, I definitely, it is that same sincerity of like, this is not a joke. It just happens to be very funny in the same way of the heel, feet, and the femur page. But like, the thing I'm really proud of, when we tweeted about it again, because we pseudo knew what we were doing, like one of the responses that really kind of warmed the cockles of my heart was just the like, oh, cool, now I can play Mirkborg and see what that was all about.
Yeah.
You know, if Mirkborg was an appreciation and love letter to this sort of history of OSR and post-OSR and new school revolution or whatever, then this was a love letter to Mirkborg that could help share what we loved about Mirkborg with people who wouldn't necessarily have felt comfortable engaging with that material, because it does, like, the Goblin Curse is real messed up.
Yeah.
Like, this thing, there's stuff in here that's like, I'm going to X-card that, and it's just me and this book. I'm not reading this page about porcelain torture kids. Like, that's too far. I'm a dad. I can't with that. So, like, you know, the fact that this might be an on-ramp for someone to see how fun violence can be is something that I take immense pleasure in.
Yeah, I know for me, I didn't realize that Merkborg was supposed to be funny until I read Duckburg. And then I was like, oh, of course Merkborg is supposed to be funny. But it really was sort of a skeleton key for me in, like, unlocking what Merkborg was all about.
And, you know, maybe you'll, invariably when you get Johan on the show, there might be some dispute about the, like,
this is a very serious game.
Yeah.
But, like, my favorite tabletop RPG is Blades in the Dark, and I don't think I've run it the same way twice.
Yeah.
Ever. You know, like, I'm not, the author isn't dead, but he's not doing great. and, like, to me, this is funny. Like, this is very, I'm hesitant to make the declarative statement, but, like.
But at least, for sure, Dan and I have both seen a lot of humor in it, and Dan just
noticed the staples on page 21. They've got this old-timey wound man, which is, for those of you playing the home game, like a classic medieval illustration to demonstrate, like, early exploration of anatomy, and it's got staples in it. Oh, I love this book so much. It is so goofy. It's so dark and so funny.
Well, and that's how we talk about it. So I think applying something that is more commonly understood to be silly and funny,
yeah,
helped to bring a different lens to this that hopefully, and it sounds like with some success, we've been able to show people this game in a different light.
I also, gosh, I have, like, three other things I want to just, like, hit on the graphic design of this book before we move on. The first is, I think there's such a lesson to be learned about finding meaning or a joke or just, like, some other little bit of fun or way to communicate your overall theme and message in every single detail of the product. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see it all over the visual design of Merkborg, as we've been talking about, or, like, the detail of the graphic design credit in the first place, like graphic design by Johan Noor and Dead People, like, mm-hmm, just the way in which the graphic design is credited conveys the theme and overall vibe of this thing.
Oh, yeah. This whole thing is really tightly, thoughtfully made.
But the other thing, to just kind of, like, close off on the graphic design here, I do think it is not without drawback in that I sat down to run this game for the first time and was like, okay, I gotta get the plain text version so I can actually understand the rules to this game. And I sat down, opened it up, started reading it with all the flavor at the beginning, and was like, oh, fuck, this writing's really good. I just never known that the writing was so good before because it's so overwhelmed by the graphic design. Like, there is a way in which the loudness of it is so effective at communicating its message that it overwhelms the message of the rules and the flavor. And maybe that's fine because, like, the thing that it cares about most is the message of its vibes and of its design. Like, I think if you went out there and were like, yeah, I would kind of plan this game however I want to, and, like, the thing I'm taking from the book is the spirit of the visuals, the creators would be like, fuck yeah, like, that's what we wanted. But it is,
I think, it is incredibly effective at communicating its tone, and this is what brings me to my favorite cinematic experience, which is The Lobster, which was, I don't think it's The Lobster's fault that it was marketed as a light romantic comedy, but it is.
Well, that's why we went to see it.
That is honestly why we.
Oh my God. You know, we watched the trailer.
We watched the trailer and we were like, oh,
that's a,
like,
weird, dark romantic comedy.
This will be a fun date night. And
it was not, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, but so we go and And Dan and I were game. We were able to roll with it and be like, all right, this isn't what we expected, but here we are. And part of the viewing for me stopped being about watching the movie itself and became about watching the rest of the audience. Because there were people who were livid in that theater, people who were throwing stuff and yelling at the movie and storming out. It was incredible. I've never been in a theater with people who were so adamantly affected by a thing. And that's a little bit what Merkborg does too. I think it is so effective at communicating its message that can be off-putting. I think the plain text version is really good for making it actually a game that people can engage with, but it's, as a whole, the original book, I don't think it is super worried about you, an individual, being able to get in there and get comfortable with it. It has a tone and it means to convey that tone, whether that helps you or not. And probably it should not help you because that's not the tone of the book.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's every time that the creators have seen somebody giving it some terrible review and somebody pops in like, hey, can we use that as a pull quote? Like, they're not trying to make a comfortable experience for you. They're trying to elicit a strong reaction. And they did that so well.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a thing that people like to say, which is that, like, at the end of the day, a tabletop RPG is a reference text. And I think when, not even quite sure how to articulate what I'm going for here, except to say, like, well, sometimes, but clearly not always.
I think it can be more than just a reference text. Yeah. If you want to write a reference text, like, great, do that. You don't have to write just a reference text. You can write an art book. You can write a reference text. You can write don't write a novel, maybe. If you want to write a novel, maybe just write a novel. But, like, there are a number of ways to approach conveying this type of information, and you don't have to limit yourself to just one.
I think the other thing that your story about going to see the lobster conveys is just how important the setting of expectations for a piece of work is, right? Like, Merkborg does this super successfully in all the ways that we've talked about. And I think as a result, people know whether this is a game for them or not really quickly. And the people,
you're not walking into it going, oh, this is a nice, light, romantic game. Cool.
But that makes people who do want this thing, it makes it really easy for them to find it, right? Like, people love this thing because it was so clear about who should come find it and love it. And when you fuck that up, like with the lobster, it's a big problem. Like, the people who really wanted to see that movie probably had a harder time finding it. And meanwhile, like, everyone in your audience hated it because they had the wrong expectations. And that setting of expectations is so critical.
Yeah. One example of this in a different way that I read recently is Fist by Claymore. RPGs, I think, is the sort of nom de plume. But it's that same sort of like, oh, this looks like Metal Gear Solid so hard, I can hear the UI as I read. Like, this is, and it is delivering on that premise, that visual premise that it has indicated that, like, nope, this is about being a bunch of weirdos with camo and, like, controlling bees and weird philosophical treaties about, and the bunch of nuke facts.
Yeah.
Like, here we go. Like, that experience, you're going to get that. And it's such a clear, like, signal flare and delivery that is, I think, the, like, top of mind, what I think of as, like, oh, yeah, you know what you're going to get, and you're going to be happy because you're going to get it. And it's the same thing with just looking at the cover of Merkborg.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for being here, Dan and Kali. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week on the show, we break down another part of Merkborg with Gem Room Games. So, okay, cool.
It's the new foreman.
We have two co-hosts this time, so we get two mechanics. So this is the mechanic that y'all brought to me. Tell us what the second mechanic from Merkborg is that we're going to talk about.
So we are going to talk about the calendar of Nechtrubel, the nameless scriptures transcribed by Anouk Schlegger the monk, which goes through 66 psalms before reaching Psalm 7:7 and the eventual end of the world, the game and your lives, and here, burn the book.
I feel like I need to get a sound effect of like a heavy tome thumping onto the table as we talk about these.
I can take it again in a voice, but I don't know if that's
yeah, no,
better.
Do it. Let's run it back.
Well, today we're here to talk about the calendar of Nechtrubel, the nameless scriptures transcribed by Anouk Schlegger the monk, Psalms 1 through 6 before Psalm 7:7, the last. The world trembles, one can feel it in ways sharp and subtle. The game and your lives end here. Burn the book.
All right, so, okay, what are these things in the fiction of Merkborg? Because there's a mechanical element here, and we'll get to that, but, like, I want to hear about the fictional context.
So the fictional context is the world is ending, and that is the hard frame of the game. That is the thing that must be true about the setting above all else for the game to make sense. And the way that is represented is you choose a die for when will all this agony end, years of pain to the end is nigh, with dice having more sides, meaning the world lasts longer.
And thus your game can be longer.
And thus a longer campaign. And every dawn in fiction, the GM rolls a die. And on a result of one, rolls on the calendar of Nechtrubel, which is almost certainly just a wild pronunciation there, which is written biblically, but is a D66 table. To find the psalm and the passage, the misery that comes to pass. And this is sort of just a randomly generated, at one day you'll wake up and the lyre arc shall make knots of the hearts of men, sundering the strongest of bonds. And that's just true now.
They're kind of prophecies.
Yeah. And like, what does that mean for the world? Like, it's kind of a vague note.
Yeah, it's pretty clear what the trees shall wither, shrivel, and die means, but it's a little bit harder to understand what, like, and the unnamed enter the earth, passing through the veil as it is sundered by Dejmon, the left underling of Nechtrubel. I don't know what that one is exactly.
But you get a vibe from it.
Yeah.
It's a strong vibe, and it's, you know, it's very interpretive. And once all of the Psalms has come to pass, then the darkness shall swallow the darkness and rules as written, you must end the campaign. Everybody dies. Everybody everywhere dies. And you have to burn your copy of Merkborg.
But which, I like it.
Which it has occurred because I know the Merkborg account has retweeted people doing it for the stunt of the thing.
You got to play rules as written.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is actually the first rule in the game that you would encounter, but it is very early on because everything before this is tone and setting. And as discussed on our last episode, it is intentionally confrontational. It's intentionally challenging and it's intentionally kind of teasing out the question of like, hey, are you going to follow all these rules?
Yeah.
Like you say you will, but like, will you? Are you really?
Are you going to commit as hard as we have?
Yeah, because we, you know, like we had to make this thing. Are you ready to do the opposite? Which, you know, the answer I think 9 times out of 10 or higher is no. But also, there's an interview with the guy who designed Risk Legacy getting really frustrated that he would put secret cards in his game and a packet that says do not open. And then people would open it and find a bunch of cards that ruin the game. And they'd be like, well, guess we got to do it. And he was like, what do you mean? Why? Stop. But that's, you know, people are funny. They'll do stuff just because it's written down. So maybe we are all burning the book if we played this game long enough. I don't know.
I think that this mechanic is incredible for a lot of reasons. It does a great job of establishing setting. It provides that narrative clock of the end of the world that's like a fire under the asses of the players to like go out there and actually get your adventuring in. Like whatever it is you want to get done here, you better get moving. And it provides like a complications table too, like a random encounters kind of thing, right? Which is doing some of that, like, you know, fire under the asses kind of thing, but on this grander scale, it sets that tone. But I also think, you know, like the game and your lives end here, burn the book, is the most rad line of text I've ever read in a game. It's just so fucking cool. Like, it does as good a job of setting the tone for what to expect from the thing in your hand as any of the art does.
Oh yeah, well, and I love that for a book that spends two full spreads on one D10 table,
yeah,
this puts so much into just one spread.
Yeah. I mean, into one sentence, like three words, burn the book. That by itself, like, it is maximalism and minimalism in this book.
Yeah. I mean, it's as a flex of tone control,
yes,
right? Of communicating what you're in for. It does an incredible job just sort of like setting the stage that, like, not necessarily do we expect you to do this, but like, this is how we are going to talk to you. And like, I don't think it's a wink. I was about to call it a wink. I don't think it's a wink, but I do think it is a good sort of like, it's so on the face of it absurd, or like, so like, you couldn't possibly mean, you know, like, and blasphemous almost, because people treasure their books. Like, this is a gorgeous work of art. You're telling me to burn it. And it does sort of like tell you a lot about the voice of the narrator and how you should, it's very instructive in how you should read the book.
Yeah.
And how you should interpret the words that are going to be coming.
Do you have a favorite psalm on the calendar?
Oh, it's like choosing between my 66 children.
See, asking me about a page and asking Dan about a psalm.
Yeah.
Kali, if you want to have a favorite psalm, you're more than welcome to.
I think my favorite psalm, because it doesn't make sense, but like, I'm no biblical scholar, but there is something very like the inherent contradiction of Psalm 2, Misery 6, and she shall see him grow stronger, and she reveals herself, and all shall be slain.
And that's okay. Just two.
Well, A, that, B, so wait, is the game over? Like, but the game doesn't end until 7-7. Again, it's that sort of, well, you can't mean what you just said, which is a grand tradition in religious study. And the sort of, like, there's sort of this really great anti-canon, like, not all of this can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, there isn't room for all of this to be true at the same time, which sort of invites, like, in metaphor and interpretation of, like, well, what do you mean all shall be slain? Like, everyone within a mile radius is a perfectly valid way to do it. And also, like, maybe everyone has changed in some way where the light has gone out of their eyes. Like, kind of doesn't matter at the end of the day, but it's very trusting that you as players are going to know what to do with this. And again, that very clear understanding of like where the book ends, the game designer ends, the document ends, and the table begins.
Mm.
And like that trust fall of like, if the authors of Merkborg care what is supposed to be the result of any of these psalms, you're not going to find it in this book. And I really appreciate the sort of stepping back and the trust that the players are going to be able to do something appropriately Morky Borgy with the prompt.
Morky Borgy! On that perfect note, I have to ask also about Duckburg's calendar, because I think that the Duckburg calendar is my favorite joke in that book. So can one of you tell me about your take on this whole calendar situation?
I think from a text editing, passing back and forth between the two of us perspective, more time was spent on that than the rest of the book combined. So the theme song is maybe not the best thing about DuckTales, but it's up there, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a stone cold classic Saturday morning theme. Like, and I think we worked backwards from like, where are we going to put the theme in here?
Because like, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, you can't not have. And it was harder than I thought, because it turns out there's not that many words in the DuckTales theme song. So it became sort of this writing exercise of like, okay, life is like a hurricane here in Duckburg, race cars, lasers, aeroplanes. It's a Duckburg. Great. That's a song. Got it. And then it was like, oh no, I've used up.
Oops, I committed.
I committed, and B, like, there's just not that much left, and I got to make 5 more songs.
Yeah.
And against this extremely minimal palette. But it also was a really great exercise because, like, the stranger got, like, we had to tell Rob, like, okay, we need the stranger. And he was like, what the fuck is the stranger? It was like, you know, from the song, there's a stranger out to find you. We made a big deal about the stranger. So we're going to need a stranger. And I don't know what that means.
But definitely in that way, doing the deep dive of the theme song to rewrite the calendar did have a strong influence on what else we brought into the book.
Well, it feels like it was an incredibly productive exercise in strip mining the theme song for iconography. Like, Merkborg at large feels like it is really powerful game of iconography with, you know, the recurring basilisks and the calendar and even the femur, you know, and the colors. And I feel like you found a lot of things in the theme song for DuckTales that we were able to draw out in the same way.
Thank you. That's a very, that makes me very happy to hear. And also it's kind of made it into a dual source of influence, just because, like, the song and the show have very little in common, aside from a general adventure motif. But, like, Scrooge is never mentioned in the theme song or the family dynamics or any of that sort of stuff. So it really kind of forced a place for, like, the lyrics of a theme song to also be alongside the, like, weird wiki deep dives we were doing on, like, episode 26, there's a gem, and it does, you know, a fun inspiration. So, like, okay, so what happens 10,000 years later and everything's all gross? Yeah. Like, what happens to this gem?
The thing that I think makes this spread, like, the act of converting the DuckTales theme song into the Merkborg calendar so powerful to me is that it becomes a statement about religion and Saturday morning cartoons, that, like, it is a state, like, the kind of wiki deep dive you are describing doing is, like, how is a wiki actually different from a Bible? Like, the difference is 2,000 years of time, right? Like, there's not a, like, that's what's going on here, right? Like, the fact that you are finding all these obscure details and, like, putting them into this, it's, like, this hilarious commentary on what it felt like to go to the church of Saturday morning cartoons and what it felt like to go to fucking Christian church for me growing up. I just think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the benefits of getting to sort of, like, as a launch pad. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. That happened. So I just have to say it. So having Merkborg as a launch pad to sort of, like, a lot of what you just said is, like, what I see in the Psalms in Merkborg. I'm like, oh, this is a really interesting, like, hey, you know, what if the Bible was totally messed up? It is.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. Like,
spoiler alert for the Bible.
Yeah.
But, like, what if the, you know, but also this sort of understanding of, well, you know how to engage with the Bible. It's weird. Like, you should engage with this in a weird way where you don't really understand what's going on. And there's thousands of years of, like, scholarship that you could engage with to continue to not understand it.
Yeah.
Of, like, saints in the year 500 saying, well, this is how we're going to think about thinking about metaphors. But also sometimes the Bible just, sometimes a cigar is a cigar. Like,
the other day I was poking around on Reddit and somebody was suggesting to somebody else that they quote the Bible to their overly religious relative, and they were providing verses that might help with this argument. And one of them mentioned busybodies And that kicked off a whole thread with people going, busybody. I didn't know that the term busybodies dated back that far. And then other people kind of being like, there have been translations.
Yeah.
It changes.
Yeah. It turns out the Hebrew word for busybody is like, no, dog, that's not.
This is not a one-to-one, actually.
But hey, Stephanie was a common name in medieval times. Yeah. So who am I? Like, the world is weird and history is piled on top of itself. And someday someone's going to find this fucking thing. And what's this duck nonsense?
And they won't have Merkborg or DuckTales to go off of. It'll just be very confusing.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of Book of the New Sun lately, so my head's in a very like, oh yeah, this is nothing and everything. Who knows?
So to bring it back to the Merkborg calendar, do you think when people burn the book that their fictional worlds are set ablaze?
I'm
going to say yes.
Yes. I'm going to cite... Like, I think, you know, John Romero's D&D campaign that he was running with the folks who were making Doom when he sold the world for a daikatana. And then, like, that brought John Carmack's, like, 500-pound campaign Bible to a close. Of like, all right, the world's over.
Yeah.
Like, I think ending worlds, even though they are much more valuable with all the time you've spent, than the MSRP $29.99 book that you can get at pretty much any friendly local game store that's worth its salt. And yet, I think people would be much more ready to destroy their worlds than they would to burn the physical book.
Well, because you can use the book to rebuild that physical world even after it has ended. Yeah. So it is tempting to revisit and have that tool at your disposal again. Although, I don't have a citation for why I said yes. It just sounded like a cool idea.
Yeah.
I have nothing to back up my absolute confidence that worlds are being burned, probably not books. And if, you know, I think that it's a lot easier in my mind. I am much more comfortable, even though in retrospect, where I place my value should probably be. But, you know, like, how often have you had a tabletop RPG campaign end properly?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, they don't. They just kind of peter out, and it's like, and things sort of, these adventures. So there is something very compelling about an ending, and baking that in, that is kind of merciful, now that I think about it, of like, yeah, we are going to end your game before it runs out of steam.
Well, especially for this delightful. Game that has so much to hit you over the head with, them going, okay, but we will stop someday.
Yeah, because we keep coming back to, as a theme in our other games, we keep coming back to this sort of immortality question in our body of work. And I think there's something I hadn't thought about until this exact moment, is the sort of like the mercy and necessity of like, your game has to end.
Yeah.
The good times have to go to a close, and it's worse if it doesn't. Like, the fading out and the unresolvedness is so much worse than like, yeah, you were halfway to this castle to do something, and then the world is on fire now.
Yeah.
Like, there's a beauty in that, that I...
Your show got canceled, but gosh, it went out with a bang.
Yeah. You know, the fiction of an apocalypse that's going to happen like that instead of a million tiny cuts is very like... Oh, yeah, I'm with you in this optimism, Merkborg team.
I mean, set the podcast on fire. Mm-hmm. It's time to go.
Burn your phone.
burn your phones and your hard drives.
Burn your phone.
Please don't. There's plastics and stuff. It's really not a good idea.
Burn the MP3 to a CD.
Yeah. Kali and Dan, thank you so much for being here. This was such a delight.
Thanks for having us. This was a delight.
Yeah, I had a great time. I learned something too.
Thanks again to Kali and Dan for being here. Again, you can find the Duckburg Kickstarter right now by Googling it. That's D-U-K-K space B-O-R-G. Or through a link in the show notes. You can find the Dice Exploder Kickstarter by Googling it, or again, in the show notes. You can find Kali on Blue Sky at Hello It's Kali, and on Twitter at KaliLA. You can find Dan on Blue Sky and Twitter at It's Dan Phipps. That's K-A-L-I for Collie and P-H-I-P-P-S for Phipps. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky, Twitter, Dice.camp, and Itch at S. Dunnewald. And there's a Dice Exploder Discord. Come and talk about the show with us if you want. Our logo was designed by Sporogory, and our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And thanks as always to you for listening. See you next time! Follow my Kickstarter! God, I didn't even mention Subway Runners. Oh, it's so good. Check it out. Someone come on the show and talk to me about Subway Runners. Gem Room Games, they make good shit.